This is April 21st, 2013, and this will be a continuation of the last week's Teisho on the environmental crisis, or part two of on the environmental crisis. It seems to me that spending two Teishos on what is arguably the greatest crisis we are facing is not too much. You could say that the greatest crisis, in a way, you could say the greatest crisis of the 19th century was racism, genocide. And this one, I would argue, it is doing what we can to avoid self-destruction. As Amala Sensei said in her article on this in a 2010 Zenbo, our species' enormous technological power isn't matched by our spiritual development. And that's particularly what I'll focus on today, is the relationship between spiritual practice, as we call it, and this huge, imposing problem of global warming and so forth. Last week we talked about these two major approaches to addressing the environmental crisis. One is the more traditional one. This can be called naturalism, which really comes down to harmonizing or striving to fit ourselves into the web of ecological interdependence. And then the other one, the other approach, is what can be called mastery. Some have called this the new environmentalism, in which we would want to try to outsmart or work around or otherwise rise above nature's laws by employing our reason and technological abilities. And as I said last week, I think this certainly has merit to it, and some would suggest that this is our only hope, is to doing something absolutely unbelievable in a technological sense to begin to slow down global warming. But I think in this context of a Zen center, a Buddhist center, I want to look more at what the first harmonizing with, and that basically arises from seeing the delusion of ourselves as apart from the environment. This is so fundamental in Zen, that we are not apart from the environment, but it's just a certain habit of thinking of dividing the world into self and other, self and environment, but that is such a limited way of understanding reality. And we see this all through the history of Zen. You see it in the koans, of course, the emphasis on a non-separation, however the world may appear through our senses, it's not fragmented, it's not divided in any way, but that we are all one mind, to put it in traditional Zen terms. I pulled out a few koans that emphasize this. Number 29 in the Mumonkan, neither the wind nor the flag. This is where the monks in, this is back in the, what is it, I think the 7th or 8th century where the monks are arguing about a flag that was flapping in the wind, and one was taking the position that it was the flag that's moving. The other said, well, yeah, in one sense, but really it's the wind that's moving. The flag wouldn't be moving unless the wind were moving, and it was really an argument about pure objectivity and pure subjectivity, to put it in philosophical terms. And then the sixth patriarch came on the scene and said, it's not the wind that's moving, it's not the flag that's moving, it's your mind that is moving. This conveys the non-dual nature of mind and things, mind and environment, which is a theme that the third patriarch emphasizes in the chant that we do sometimes, affirming faith in mind. Things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff Record where the great Shuefeng, or Seppo in Japanese, he's addressing the monks and he says, pick up the whole great earth in your fingers and it is as big as a grain of rice. This is what unfolds, this is the kind of vision that unfolds naturally through long practices, seeing in each thing, each individual thing, a blade of grass, the petal of a flower, a grain of rice, seeing the whole. The great Yunmen, another famous Chinese master, or Ummon, was asked by a monk, what is the pure body of reality? He said, a flowering hedge. Another Chinese master, Sung Zhao, famously said, heaven and earth and I are of the same root. All things and I are of one substance. It's not just Buddhists who had this understanding, of course. John Muir, the great naturalist, said, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. And it goes all the way back to the Buddha, who we were told when he was first born, the legend is that he took seven steps, he raised his right hand up to the heavens, and he pointed his left hand down to the earth, and he said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world-honored one. Alone. No other. No nature apart from me, no environment apart from me, no things apart from me, alone, all one. Thank you. But because of our ancient delusions, we fail to see this. Our senses deceive us into thinking that we are separate. Things are separate. Things are not fundamentally whole and one. And from this, all the trouble starts. If we could expand our sense of self in the way that the great awakened masters have all done, then we would understand that that we would see the destruction of the environment as self-destruction, which it is. Last week I read some from a growing discipline, or at least train a way of thinking called eco-psychology. I read some from an article by Theodore Roszak, mentioned how, just as in the case of addictions to alcohol or drugs, how little good it is to just shame the person and try to instill guilt in the person, how ineffective that is. In the same way, he suggests quite plausibly that it's not going to help us come to terms with this looming disaster called global warming if we just shut down and feel guilty. That's really the real enemy, is, as I said last week, is this sense of hopelessness or helplessness. This came out in our meeting yesterday. We had a sort of an inaugural meeting of people interested in discussing and doing something about this crisis, and what many of us expressed is this feeling of helplessness. One person said feeling tiny, and as if nothing that I, any one of us, can do will make a difference. Sense of inevitability, and informing oneself of this dire situation wouldn't necessarily help in that regard, because it's very, very sobering. What makes it all the more difficult, all the more imposing, is how the institutions of our society that ideally we would look to galvanize and organize us in doing something about this are really a big part of the problem. In the magazine I read some from last week called Tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N, which is a word that means to mend or repair or transform the world. One article in a series of articles about the ecological crisis was by Mark Hathaway, called Spirituality in a Time of Crisis. He doesn't say he's a Buddhist, but everything about this article speaks from Buddhist ethic. And he co-authored a book called The Tao of Liberation, a 2009 book. And he makes a neat point here. He says, today he talks about greed, anger, and delusion, or greed. Anger can also be understood as more generally as ill will or hostility or enmity. And he says that today our economic system has institutionalized greed, our militarism has institutionalized ill will, and our corporate media has institutionalized delusion. For the first, the greed, the institutionalization of greed, he says consumer capitalism institutionalizes greed in at least two ways. Corporations are never profitable enough, and people never consume enough. To increase profits, we must be conditioned into finding the meaning of our lives in buying and consuming. But we can never earn or consume enough. He cites as examples of institutionalized ill will or hostility, racism, our punitive judicial system, the treatment of undocumented immigrants. But the best example, he says, by far, is the plague of militarism. And then the third one, delusion. He says genuine democracy requires an independent and activist press to expose, abuse, and discuss vital issues. As profit-making megacorporations whose bottom line is advertising revenue, however, the main concern of the media is to do whatever maximizes those profits. An important part of genuine education is realizing that many of the things we think are natural and inevitable, and therefore should accept, are in fact conditioned and therefore can be changed. The world does not need to be the way it is. There are other possibilities. The present role of the media is to foreclose most of those possibilities by confining public awareness and discussion within narrow limits. Since we already have the best possible political and economic systems, as the thinking goes, all that's needed is a few minor adjustments. The media normalize the situation so that we accept it and continue to perform our required roles, especially the frenzied production and consumption necessary to keep the economy growing. If I hear one more time someone on TV say, "We're the greatest nation in the world," I'm going to throw up. You know? The only way you could make that kind of claim is having lived, I don't know, 10 or 20 years in every other country in the world. It's such blind jingoism. But don't get me started. And every time I say something like that, then I can imagine someone saying, "Oh, you hate the United States." No, there are so many wonderful, wonderful, amazing things about the United States. Above all, I would say, is our ability to self-correct. Our government, as flawed as it is we have this ability to self-correct, which, I don't know, maybe more than other countries, most other countries. I agree with a researcher I met at a conference on the Mind and Life Institute annual conference, who is from New Zealand, who said America shows the best and the worst of the world, of human nature. We saw plenty of both this past week, since part one of this Taisho last week. For those of you who are hearing this maybe years from now, we had the bombing at the Boston Marathon. We had the explosion in West, in Texas, and all the rest that everyone knows about. So the enemy, we can talk about all these institutions that have, in which we see greed, anger, and delusion entrenched and fostered. But really, in Zen, it's the responsibility for each one of us to look and see how we're contributing to it, how we're helping it or perpetuating it. felt so helpful in the meeting yesterday to hear people openly express their pain at what's happening into the natural world. And I think this is crucial to acknowledge this. Joanna Macy, who has been for decades a leader in the ecological movement, emphasizes the importance of getting in touch with the pain, because it's so the pain is so can be so severe when we see what's happening that we just have to feel obliged to block it out. I think this is what so many, I think millions of people do this. They can't face the pain of what's happening and the how dreadful are the prospects for our children and grandchildren. And so it's the classic way of dealing with pain. We know this from when we get started in Zen practice, is blocking it, trying to find other things to escape it in the mind, mental things to escape it. So it may be true that the first step is to really acknowledge our anguish at the scale of this problem, because it probably isn't until we feel this anguish, this pain, that we'll be motivated to do anything about it. That's the Buddha's first noble truth, is suffering, and he makes it first. I'm sure he made it the first of the four noble truths, because it's only when we feel enough pain that we are moved to do anything about it, moved to change. But it can be a major obstacle, this denial. There's an article I also started to read from on this wonderful website, ecobuddhism.org. And I would suggest that anyone who feels this sense of hopelessness or isolation, that you go to this website, ecobuddhism.org, and you'll find a lot that will tend to neutralize that feeling of hopelessness. There's an article here that I started reading last week called The Ecological Unconscious by Daniel Smith. He talks at the end of the article, about this, a number of psychiatrically inflicted coinages have sprung up to represent people's growing unease over the state of the planet. Nature deficit disorder, eco-anxiety, eco-paralysis. And then it says that eco-psychologists propose a new clinical approach based on the idea that treating patients in an age of ecological crisis requires more than current therapeutic approaches offer. It requires tapping into what Rozak called our ecological unconscious. I'm just going to read a few select things here. About a psychologist, a cognitive psychologist who conducted a study whose purpose was to validate attention restoration theory, which posits a stark difference in the ability of natural and urban settings to improve cognition. Attention restoration theory holds that nature increases focus and memory, because it is filled with, quote, soft fascinations, rustling trees, bubbling water, that give those high-level functions the leisure to replenish, whereas urban life is filled with harsh stimuli, car horns, billboards, that can cause cognitive overload. In Berman's study, the nature walkers showed a dramatic improvement while the city walkers did not, demonstrating nature's restorative effects on cognition. In Rochester, we have the blessing of being able to get ourselves into a natural environment, either a park within the city or nature outside the city limits. We can access these things much more easily than those who are deep in a major metropolitan area. In the article by Theodore Roszak, What is Eco-Psychology? He says, nature heals is one of the oldest therapeutic dicta. Eco-psychologists are finding new ways to apply that ancient insight. Over a century ago, Emerson lamented that few adult persons can see nature. If they could, they would know that in the woods we return to reason and faith. There I feel that nothing can befall me in life, no disgrace or calamity which nature cannot repair. Don't we all have an intuitive sense that this is true? I have advised people who have just suffered loss, death, to get out in the woods or the fields or there's no doubt in my mind but doing so is therapeutic, is healing. But then for those who can't do so as often as they'd like, we have the ultimate wilderness or space, which is this realm of no mind that we can access not only every time we sit, but any time we have the presence of mind to let go of our thoughts and just come back to this present moment right here. This present moment that is unstained by thought. This is the inexpressible richness that every single one of us has, is this realm of no mind. We don't have to be dependent on getting out into nature, although it's of course it can help. But what's nature? We are nature. I think the real meaning of that word is our natural state, unfettered by thought. It's thought that takes us away from our innate harmony with nature. It's thought that causes us to imagine that there's this world out there apart from us that we can exploit for our own good, our own profit. Joanna Macy says that success is widely seen as how fast materials can be extracted from the earth and turned into consumer products, weapons, and waste. Success, economic success, corporate success, how fast materials can be extracted from the earth and turned into consumer products, weapons, and waste. So it is enormously sobering, the problem that we face. But there is hope, certainly. I began reading last week from an article by Frances Moore LaPay called Free Your Eco Mind, and she offers hope in the sense of what we share. What is innate to human beings? I read the first two last week, cooperation and empathy. Others she lists are fairness, efficacy. She says, could our species have made it this far if we were essentially couch potatoes, shoppers, and whiners? I don't think so. We are doers. Our need to make a dent in the wider world is so great, argued Eric Fromm, that we should toss out René Descartes' theorem, I think, therefore I am, and replace it with, I am because I effect. I effect change. She says the trait seems to show up even in tiny babies. 3-month-olds respond with pleasure to a moving mobile, but a study shows that they prefer to look at a mobile they can influence themselves. They smile and coo at it more, too. And she cites other experiments. A fifth trait that we all share, that is common to us, that can give us hope is a sense of meaning. We seek ways to give our days value beyond ensuring our own survival. And she says the prominence of religion certainly attests to this need. Sixth, imagination, creativity, and attraction to change. She quotes a Professor Alison Gopnik in the book The Philosophical Baby, in which he writes, more than any other creature, human beings are able to change. What neuroscientists call plasticity, the ability to change in light of experience, is the key to human nature at every level, from brains to minds to societies. The very fact that this crisis is of our own making means that it's possible for us to unmake it. We don't have to just fatalistically participate in the destruction of our biosphere. In the in our meeting yesterday, a couple of people, at least two or three, talked about their wanting to get someone, one person said, getting unreasonably involved. So against all reason. You know, if you read enough about the terrible trajectory of ecological disaster, the mind of reason can convince you that it's too late. And maybe it is. Do we have the courage to acknowledge that it's maybe too late? Maybe we've reached this tipping point where these immense systems of the oceans and the air are beyond reversal. And there are those who believe that. But can we acknowledge that may be the case? Who knows for sure? It's all so mysterious. But can we acknowledge that may be the case, but going to do something anyway, do what we can anyway? This, I think, is where the unreasonableness of Zen, the radical, the ill, the contradictory or paradoxical nature of reality really comes forth, that Zen emphasizes all the time. It's that it's beyond, that reality is beyond anything we can understand with our intellects, our reason, our logic. George Bernard Shaw said, "The one who listens to reason is lost. Reason enslaves all whose minds are not strong enough to master it." He might have been talking about Zen. Reason has its place, of course, but there is more to reality, to the mind, than reason. In fact, it's really quite a small part of it. The field of emergent systems is gaining attention in recent years, where we just don't know what can emerge through change, through, in this case, human beings getting together and with energy and commitment doing something. Someone else in the meeting yesterday talked about disconnecting from the outcome. This is Zen practice as well. Of sitting not in order to get something, which is reasonable enough. That's our reason operating. Okay, we're going to sit so that we can change. What's wrong with that? That's perfectly useful motivation, especially in early on in practice. But until we can sit for its own sake, just lose any notions of goals, of getting anything, that until then, this practice, this great Dharma, will not really reveal its incomprehensible riches. That's the task before us in Zen. It's a task before us in work like this, is to, as T.S. Eliot says, teach us to care and not to care. I don't care if I never come to awakening in this lifetime. I'm doing this because I have to, because so many people rely on my doing this practice, on my purifying my mind, because in doing so, I'm not just purifying my own mind. Frank Waters, in his well-known book, The Man Who Killed the Deer, again was expressing the spirit of Zen when he said, "Nothing is simple and alone. We are not separate and alone. the breathing mountains, the living stones, each blade of grass, the clouds, the rain, each star, the beasts and the invisible spirits of the air, we are all one, indivisible. Let me jump over to another koan. This is from the Blue Cliff Record, number 83. It's called Umon's The Ancient Buddha and the Pillar. So here Umon was speaking to his disciples, and he said, "The ancient Buddha and the pillar merge. What level of spiritual activity is this?" He himself answered for them, saying, "Clouds gather over the southern hill, rain falls on the northern mountain." Clouds gather over the southern hill, rain falls on the northern mountain. Another master just put it this way, and I'll just use local places. The cows of Monroe County eat grass, and the cows of Wyoming County get fat. It's one thing to say we're all one, everything is one, but it's this, what's so wonderful about Zen is this use of concrete imagery, things, bringing it to the physical, to live images. And then Frank Waters continues, "So I would have you look upon this thing not as a separate, simple thing, but as a stone which is a star in the firmament of earth, as a ripple in a pool, as a kernel of corn. I would have you consider how it fits into the whole, how far its influence may spread, what it may grow into." Or as Hakuin said, "I am the sun and the moon and the stars and the wide, wide earth." One more koan that I think fits into this matter of the seemingly impossible task of changing these enormous systems and changing institutionalized greed, ill will, and delusion before we destroy ourselves. This is number 62 in the Blue Cliff Record, Umon's One Treasure. Umon said to the assembled monks, "Between heaven and earth, through space and time, there is one treasure hidden in the mountain of form. Pick up a lamp and go into the Buddha hall. Take the temple gate and place it on the lamp." Now, I'm going to comment on this koan just from my own interpretation of it in terms of the ecological crisis. This didn't come from ancient China because there was no such thing in those days. But I think there's something really applicable here. Between heaven and earth, throughout space and time, there is this one treasure. Masters have called it true nature, Buddha nature, self nature, original mind, essential nature, essential mind. It is hidden in all phenomena, all beings. And then he says, "Pick up a lamp and go into the Buddha hall." In terms of just our topic today, I would see this as informing ourselves, first of all, because that can be what's most galvanizing. But even more important, I would say, is noticing the miracle that is our natural world. To notice, it helps a lot to sit, because we can go through our daily lives pretty blind and ignorant of what's going on around us. So, as always, I see it's starting with sitting. Sitting opens the mind. It makes us aware. You could say that all of Buddhist meditation comes down to that word awareness or noticing. And then when we really do notice things, then we see them with awe, with reverence, with wonder. No one needs to take my word for this. Just keep sitting. And you see it most commonly, you see it in Sesshin when you're sitting 10 or more hours a day. That's when you acquire this whole fresh vision of seeing things as they are, not dimmed and grayed through thoughts. The author of the article I read earlier, the article in Tikkun magazine, Mark Hathaway, he says, on a collective level, work around earth literacy can serve as a doorway to this kind of awareness, especially if the kind of learning involved transcends the realm of information to truly serve as an experiential awakening to the beauty and wisdom of our local ecosystems. Our local ecosystems. We don't have to go to Africa or to the Himalayas to find this kind of awe. So one way to understand this first sentence, pick up a lamp and go into the Buddha hall, the lamp of awareness, of seeing things in their absolutely amazing, wondrous reality. And then take the temple gate and place it on the lamp. How do you do that? This is a tough koan. Everyone has trouble with this one, just as I did. How can you do the seemingly impossible? All koans are pointing to this one mind of which we are all a part. All phenomena, all beings, sentient and insentient, are a part. And so if all koans are pointing to that, then the root, the source of every koan is this mind of oneness. So resolving a koan like this ecological crisis, starts with the realization, the awareness that what we think of as out there is not out there. It's not apart from us. The temple gate is not out there. The so-called environment is not out there. When we say all beings without number, I vow to liberate, those all beings are not out there. It's one of the most common questions I've heard over the years is, how can I presume to liberate all beings when I'm not, haven't liberated myself. Well, who says they're different? That strike of the bell means we're at 10:30 and our time is up. That strike of the bell that's not out there. So we'll stop now and recite the four vows.